On July 1, 1863, the tide of the American Civil War changed. That was the first of 3 days of battle at Gettysburg, a town in Pennsylvania just north of the Maryland state line. Confederate General Robert E. Lee was leading an offensive push into Northern Territory, a clear sign that things weren't going well for the Union. Looking back now, many historians point to the Union victory at Gettysburg that stopped Lee's push into the North as a turning point in the war. Militarily, it was a hard-fought and costly affair for both sides, without a clear-cut outcome. But politically, it became something else. The Union needed to prove to its citizens and the world that they were capable of winning the war. After Gettysburg, confidence in President Lincoln and the Northern war effort rose, and the enormous sacrifice of the battle became a totem for the righteousness of the Union cause, immortalized in President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address several months later. It was the growing symbolism of the battle that made it important, and why that battlefield site is still today the number one visited in America. So who better to tell the deep and detailed story of those 3 days and their context and consequence than a podcast featuring the voices of Gettysburg's licensed battlefield guides? Today's Saturday Matinee features a portion of one of the narrative episodes from the podcast Addressing Gettysburg. It features lectures, discussions, Q&As with battlefield guides, and more. I hope you enjoy. And while you're listening, search for and follow Addressing Gettysburg. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
You're listening to Addressing Gettysburg.
The Battle of Gettysburg can trace its origins back to September of 1862, when Robert E. Lee audaciously led his Army of Northern Virginia on an invasion of the North. Since taking command in June of 1862, Lee had beaten back Major General George B. McClellan's Army of the Potomac and secured the Confederate capital of Richmond during the Peninsula Campaign. He then moved to Northern Virginia, where he thrashed Major General John Pope's Union Army of Virginia in August at the Battle of Second Manassas. After this victory, Lee strategically chose to keep his aggressive momentum going rather than settle into a defensive posture around Richmond. So he turned his attention to Northern Territory, specifically Pennsylvania, probably Harrisburg. This, Lee knew, would draw the Union Army out of Virginia. He had political, diplomatic, and logistical factors in mind when making this move. Lee's fervent reading of Yankee newspapers gave him the confidence that this move would further strain relations between political factions in the North. It was his belief that Union forces were weakened and demoralized, and that a successful invasion and occupation of Northern Territory through the autumn months would deliver a crushing blow to the Union war effort and finally bring about Southern independence. With the fall elections looming, a Confederate invasion of Maryland and Pennsylvania would certainly hurt Lincoln and the Republicans. Should he find himself meeting the Army of the Potomac on some Pennsylvania battlefield, Lee was confident his Army of Northern Virginia would, once again, carry the day, and this time, bring recognition from Great Britain and France, or, at the very least, caused them to intercede to moderate for Southern independence. Arguably, the most important and perhaps the most attainable was logistics. Lee's army was plagued with shortages of food for men and horses alike. The farms of Northern Virginia had been exhausted from 2 years of tens of thousands of troops, both Northern and Southern, trampling the ground and confiscating crops. Occupation of Maryland and southern Pennsylvania would give these Virginia farmers a much-needed respite and an opportunity to bring their crops to maturity and harvest. Meanwhile, Lee would be able to provision his army with food, fodder, and other supplies from the lush and untouched farmlands of Maryland and Pennsylvania's Cumberland Valley, known south of the Potomac River as the Shenandoah Valley. This move was not to gain territory, but to buy time to accomplish his goals until returning to Virginia for the winter. 8 months later, many of these same concerns will propel Lee to invade the North a second time, an invasion which culminated in the fight at Gettysburg. Lee wrote to Confederate President Jefferson Davis on September 3rd, "The army is not properly equipped for an invasion of an enemy's territory. It lacks much of the material of war, is feeble in transportation, the animals being much reduced, and the men are poorly provided with clothes, and in thousands of instances are destitute of shoes. Still, we cannot afford to be idle, and though weaker than our opponents in men and military equipments, must endeavor to harass if we cannot destroy them. I am aware that the movement is attended with much risk, yet I do not consider success impossible and shall endeavor to guard it from loss." The North, meanwhile, would have to protect its capital, Washington, D.C., from attack by Lee's army from the northwest and therefore interpose its army between Lee and Washington. Lee had hoped that thousands of Marylanders would rush to join the cause and swell his ranks, and he had good reason for such hopes. In 1861, riots broke out in Baltimore. Members of the state legislature and Baltimore's mayor had been imprisoned for several weeks. Habeas corpus had been suspended, and thousands of Marylanders wondered if those civil rights that they had left would withstand the duration of the war. Lee, like many Southerners, believed Maryland only remained in the Union at the point of a musket, rather than out of loyalty. On September 8th, Lee issued a proclamation to Marylanders stating, "The people of the Confederate States have long watched, with the deepest sympathy, the wrongs and outrages that have been inflicted upon the citizens of a commonwealth allied to the states of the South by the strongest social, political, and commercial ties." Lee had divided his army and spelled out where each wing was to go with Special Orders No. 191. Lieutenant General Stonewall Jackson's men were tasked with taking the arsenal and garrison at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. The rest of the army was to fall back from the Frederick area to Hagerstown. On September 13th, a Union corporal outside of Frederick, Maryland, came across a bundle of cigars wrapped in paper. Excited to find some cigars, the corporal almost discarded the paper until he noticed writing on it. It was a copy of Robert E. Lee's Special Orders No. 191. The orders made its way up the ranks to McClellan, who famously said, "Here is a paper with which, if I cannot whip Bobby Lee, I will be willing to go home." By September 16th, Harper's Ferry had fallen, and Jackson's corps, save A.P. Hill's division, which was en route from Harper's Ferry, had been reunited with Longstreet and Lee on the bluffs along the Antietam Creek, outside of Sharpsburg, Maryland. Early that misty morning, Confederate guns opened fire from the high ground northwest of town. The bloodiest 12-hour period in American history was underway. When it was all over, 23,000 Americans would be killed, wounded, or missing. The Battle of Antietam is considered a draw, and Lee withdrew his army back into Virginia. Lee's first invasion of the North had ended.
History Daily is sponsored by ClickUp. You've heard the phrase, work smarter, not harder, but I'd like to add a corollary, work faster, not longer. They're related because to work fast, you kind of need to work smart. Be efficient, stay on track, and imagine working so smart and so fast that you suddenly find yourself with an extra day every week. ClickUp is the productivity platform that'll save you one day a week on work, guaranteed. ClickUp began with the premise that productivity was broken. There were too many tools to keep track of, too many things in entirely separate ecosystems. There had to be a more productive way to get through the daily hustle. ClickUp is the one tool to house all your tasks, projects, docs, goals, spreadsheets, and more. And it's built for teams from 1 to over 1,000. It's packed with features and customization options that no other productivity tool has, so you can work the way you work best. Whether you're in project management, engineering, sales, marketing, or HR, ClickUp has easy-to-use solutions that create a more efficient work environment. So join the more than 800,000 highly productive teams using ClickUp today. Use code HISTORY to get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Sign up today at ClickUp.com and use code HISTORY. But hurry, this offer ends soon.
For 6 weeks after the Battle of Antietam, McClellan remained near Sharpsburg. During this time, Lincoln tried to persuade, coax, cajole, threaten, and argue with McClellan to move his army in pursuit of Lee. Finally, towards the end of October, McClellan crossed the Potomac in feeble pursuit of Lee. His crossing of the Potomac alone took 9 days. Lincoln had had his fill of McClellan for once and for all. By November, Lincoln fired McClellan. Taking his place was Ambrose E. Burnside, a general who is best described as a modest man with much to be modest about. Upon taking command, Burnside planned an aggressive offensive against Richmond, Virginia, by way of Fredericksburg. But this boldness was immediately met with troubles crossing the Rappahannock River. This gave Robert E. Lee time to entrench his army on Marie's Heights, behind the town of Fredericksburg. By December 11th, construction of the pontoons had begun. General William Barksdale's Confederate Brigade of Mississippians held the town and made the task of laying the bridges difficult for Union engineers. Union artillery opened on the town to quiet Barksdale's sharpshooters to little effect. The first major urban combat of the Civil War began in Fredericksburg when the 7th Michigan and the 19th and 20th Massachusetts crowded into boats and crossed the river to secure the bridgehead and clear the town of Barksdale's brigade. Over 5,000 rounds of artillery ordnance were expended in the effort. Fighting through the town was street to street, with some Confederates surrendering while others continued the fight. By nightfall, Fredericksburg was occupied by 4 Union brigades. Looting was rampant. Naturally, many Confederate soldiers were Virginians, and their anger readied them for the battle they knew would come. Even many Union soldiers were appalled by such wanton disregard for private property. Surprisingly, with all the violence and destruction in the town of Fredericksburg, only an estimated 4 civilians lost their lives. On December 13th, Burnside ordered the battle begin. The Confederate right, held by Stonewall Jackson's 40,000 men, was attacked by Major General George Gordon Meade's 4,000-man division. Meade's men were able to find a gap in Jackson's line and exploit it before being pushed back by Jackson's reinforcements, led by Brigadier Generals Jubal A. Early and William Tolliver. When Meade sent an aide to fellow division commander Brigadier General David Birney for assistance, Birney refused, citing that he did not work for Meade and they weren't even members of the same corps. Meade rode furiously back to Birney's position and yelled at him with such terrible profanities that a staff officer described them as words that almost make the stones creep underfoot, trying to get away. Profanities notwithstanding, Meade, who outranked Birney, pulled rank and was able to get a brigade released to aid in the attack. But it was too little, too late. As the fighting along Jackson's line dissipated on the south end of the battlefield, the distant sounds of gunfire in the fields to the north could be heard in front of Marie's Heights, just west of the city. While Meade was attacking Jackson, Union troops had initiated an attack against Longstreet's well-entrenched men on Marie's Heights. orders from Burnside were to send a division or more in an effort to seize the high ground west of Fredericksburg. The approach was fraught with difficulties. Fences, gardens, a canal, narrow bridges over the canal, and scattered homes, barns, and eventually the fallen, all promised to break up and slow the Federal advance over the open plain. Longstreet's men were hidden behind a stone wall that ran along a sunken road at the base of the heights, known at that time as the Telegraph Road. Major General Lafayette McClaws had about 2,000 men on the front line and an additional 7,000 reserves on the crest of and behind Marie's Heights. Batteries pointing in every possible direction had very few target-deficient spots on the Union approaches. Lieutenant Colonel Edward Porter Alexander, Longstreet's artillery commander, told him, "General, we cover that ground now so well that we will comb it as with a fine-tooth comb. A chicken could not live on that field when we open on it." At about noon, Kimball's Union Brigade from French's division stepped off. The advance was slow, and they were immediately under artillery fire from Alexander's guns. Kimball's men fixed bayonets and dressed their lines in good order at the bottom of the hill before making their assault. Off they went up the slope. They made it to within 125 yards of the wall before being cut down by a murderous and consistent musketry from the Confederate lines. Then came more brigades, one after another, each one with soldiers bent forward as if walking into a blizzard. Each one stepping over other boys in blue. Each one slipping on ground made muddy and slick by the blood of their fallen comrades. Next, Major General Winfield Scott Hancock's division emerged to suffer the same fate as French's. The Irish Brigade, commanded by General Thomas Francis Marr, was first to go up. Before going into battle, Marr addressed his men, saying, "This may be my last speech to you, but I will be with you when the battle is the fiercest. And if I fall, I can say I did my duty and fell fighting in the most glorious of causes." His men gave him three cheers. Marr remained behind, naming a bum knee as the cause. On the order, shoulder arms, right face, forward, double quick march, the Irishmen raced towards the enemy. Immediately, they came under artillery fire. One well-placed Confederate shell exploded among the 88th New York, taking out 18 men. After splashing through the canal at the bottom of the hill, the order, "Attention," rang out through the ranks, followed by, "Fix bayonets." One Union officer remembered, "As this was being done, the clink-clink of the cold steel sounding along the line made one's blood run cold." Marr gave the order to advance at the double quick, and with a yell, the Irish Brigade moved across the plain and up the slope of Marie's Heights. Opposing them, behind the wall, were fellow Sons of Erin in the 24th Georgia of Cobb's Brigade. "Oh God, what a pity! Here comes Marr's fellows," a member of the 24th lamented. "Give it to him now, boys," the 24th commander yelled. "Now's the time. Give it to him." The Confederate line opened fire with a galling sheet of flame. Still, the men of the Irish Brigade pressed on, ignoring the carnage around them. Mulholland added, "No cheers or wild hurrahs as they moved towards the foe. They were not there to fight, only to die." The brigade made it to within 50 yards of the Confederate wall, resembling a mob more than a military unit. It managed to squeeze off a few rounds before retreating back down the hill. The Irish Brigade suffered 45% casualties, including 14 of its 15 field officers. Only one colonel, Colonel Patrick Kelly, survived unscathed. By day's end, Burnside sent 7 Union divisions against Marie's Heights, one brigade at a time, making a total of 14 individual charges, each of which failed, costing the United States Army around 7,500 casualties. The total Union casualties in the Battle of Fredericksburg were well over 12,000. Confederate losses at Marye's Heights totaled around 1,200, and their total losses in the battle were just over 5,000. General Longstreet wrote, "The charges had been desperate and bloody, but utterly hopeless." 6.5 months later, on Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg, Hancock's Union soldiers would be behind a wall as Longstreet's men marched across open fields. During that cold December night on the fields leading to Marye's Heights, thousands of Union soldiers were pinned down by Confederate fire, unable to move or assist the wounded. No one seems to have captured the scene in a more moving way than the Lieutenant Colonel of the 20th Maine Regiment, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. "The desperate charge was over. We had not reached the enemy's fortifications, but only the fatal crest, where we had seen five lines of battle mount, but to be cut to earth, as by a sword swoop of fire. We had that costly honor which sometimes falls to the reserve, to go in when all is havoc and confusion, through storm and slaughter, to cover the broken and depleted ranks of comrades, and take the battle from their hands. Thus we had replaced the gallant few still struggling on the crest, and received that withering fire which nothing could withstand, by throwing ourselves flat in a slight hollow of the ground, within pistol shot of the enemy's works, and mingled with the dead and dying that strewn the field, we returned the fire till it reddened into night, and at last fell away through darkness and silence. But out of that silence, from the battle's crash and roar, rose new sounds, more appalling still, rose or fell, you knew not which, or whether from the earth or air, a strange ventriloquism, of which you could not locate the source, a smothered moan that seemed to come from distances beyond reach of the natural sense, a wail so far and deep and wide, as if a thousand discords were flowing together into a keynote, weird, unearthly, and terrible to hear and bear, yet startling with its nearness. The writhing concord broken by cries for help, pierced by shrieks of paroxysm, some begging for a drop of water, some calling on God for pity, and some on friendly hands to finish what the enemy had so horribly begun. Some with delirious, dreamy voices, murmuring loved names, as if the dearest were bending over them. Some gathering their last strength to fire a musket, to call attention to them where they lay helpless and deserted. And underneath, all the time, that deep bass note from closed lips, too hopeless or too heroic to articulate their agony. At last, outwearied and depressed with the desolate scene, my own strength sank, and I moved two dead men a little and lay down between them, making a pillow of the breast of a third. The skirt of his overcoat drawn over my face helped also to shield me from the bleak winds. There was some comfort even in this companionship.
History Daily is sponsored by the Jordan Harbinger Show. So I will confess, I don't really follow basketball. Not my favorite. But of course, I know who Shaquille O'Neal is. But what I did not know about Shaq is that he might think the Earth is flat. My goodness, he's tall enough to see the curvature of the Earth with his own eyes. How could he believe that? So obviously, I had to listen to Shaq's appearance on the Jordan Harbinger Show. Jordan has a talent for getting guests to share their best stories and insights. In every episode, he pulls out bits of wisdom that will leave you a more informed, critical thinker and more aware of the world around you. In talking to Shaq, Jordan finally gets him to reveal the truth behind his flat earth thinking. Was it a joke or a conspiracy? I'm not going to tell you the answer because that would ruin what was a fascinating conversation, proving again that you can't go wrong with adding the Jordan Harbinger Show to your rotation. It's incredibly interesting and there's never a dull show. So search for the Jordan Harbinger Show That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
By December 15th, Burnside had called off the attacks and withdrew across the Rappahannock. He blamed his subordinates for the failure of the attacks. Upon viewing the destruction done to the city of Fredericksburg, a member of Stonewall Jackson's staff asked what could be done about this kind of barbaric behavior. Jackson simply replied, "Kill 'em. Kill 'em all." Fredericksburg was a massive failure for Burnside and plunged Union morale to a new low. As 1862 came to a close, Lee congratulated his troops on a job well done for the year, but warned them that their work is not yet complete and that the enemy, or those people, as Lee often referred to the Union Army, had outproduced them in manpower, materiel, and treasure. In January 1863, after the Federal defeat at Fredericksburg, Major General Ambrose E. Burnside sought to restore the Army's morale by crossing the Rappahannock River at Banks's Ford, 2 miles south, to attack the rear of Robert E. Lee's army. The march began on January 19th. That night, a warm front thawed the frozen roads with 48 hours of pouring rain. Confederates across the river taunted the sodden Federals with large signs. "This way to Richmond." And perhaps the most humiliating, "Burnside stuck in the mud," painted on a barn roof. One Confederate yelled across the river, "Say, Yanks, we'll be over in the morning and haul your guns out of the mud for you." Burnside canceled the march on January 23rd. And 2 days later, President Abraham Lincoln replaced him with Major General Joseph Hooker, the third man to command the Army of the Potomac in 3 months. Major General Joseph Hooker came to command of the Army of the Potomac by undermining Ambrose Burnside in any way he could, while politicking and forming a band of Hooker loyalists within the high command of the Army. Being fully aware of this and in spite of it, Lincoln gave Hooker the command. In a letter to the general, dated January 26, 1863, Lincoln wrote, "I think that during General Burnside's command of the army, you have taken counsel of your ambition and thwarted him as much as you could. I have heard in such a way as to believe it of your recently saying that both the army and the government needed a dictator. Of course, it was not for this, but in spite of it, that I have given you the command. Only generals who gain successes can set up dictators. What I now ask of you is military success, and I will risk the dictatorship. I much fear that the spirit which you have aided to infuse into the army, of criticizing their commander and withholding confidence from him, will now turn upon you. Neither you nor Napoleon, if he were alive again, could get any good out of an army while such a spirit prevails in it." For all his bombast, Fighting Joe Hooker played a crucial role in the evolution and condition of the Army of the Potomac. Upon taking command, Hooker implemented changes that made the Army easier to manage and that improved the health and morale of its troops. The Grand Division organization was done away with and replaced with a simple structure in which each corps reported directly to Army headquarters. The cavalry, which had previously been divvied up among the various infantry divisions, was now organized in its own corps. While Hooker brought the cavalry together in one unit, he did the opposite with the artillery, dispersing batteries throughout the infantry units as required. He did away with McClellan's ineffective system of utilizing the Pinkerton Agency, comprised of all civilians, and instead formed the Bureau of Military Information, or BMI, under Colonel George Sharp. The BMI analyzed information gathered from prisoners, spies, cavalry reports, balloons, the locations of cuts in telegraph wires, and a variety of other sources not yet fully explored by either army in the Civil War. To improve morale, Hooker fixed the daily diet of his soldiers. He added and monitored company cooks and improved camp sanitary conditions. He made sure the troops were paid on time, and he made the quartermaster department accountable for supplies that were meant for the front. Hospitals received major reforms, and he improved the furlough system, allowing one man per company to take turns receiving a 10-day furlough. In order to stem the tide of rising desertion, Hooker improved the incoming mail review, bolstered camp picket lines, improved the drilling of his soldiers, and the training of his officers, who he gave permission to shoot the deserters. Unit pride was improved by the introduction of the Corps badge system, designed to make identification of troops in the thick of battle easier. Taps was introduced by the new Chief of Staff, Daniel Butterfield. The song was a slight modification of Tattoo, a song written by General Winfield Scott in 1835. All of these things will help the Army of the Potomac turn into the fighting force it had become by the time of the Battle of Gettysburg. But that was still months away. Hooker boasted, "I have the finest army on the planet. I have the finest army the sun ever shone on. If the enemy does not run, God help them. May God have mercy on General Lee, for I will have none." Joe Hooker was plotting and planning a great campaign that would take his army across the Rappahannock yet again, but this time, not straight at the city of Fredericksburg. Instead, Hooker would hold a portion of his army, under Major General John Sedgwick at Falmouth, across from the city, while marching the remainder north to swing down on Lee's flank. Lee, on the other hand, had sent almost half of his army away on a foraging mission under the command of Lieutenant General James Longstreet. This had to be done because the Confederate Army was always plagued by shortages of food, clothing, and other supplies and equipment. Remaining with Lee were the men of Stonewall Jackson's corps and two of Longstreet's divisions. Hooker had Lee outnumbered 2-1. Moreover, Hooker had gotten his army safely across the Rappahannock and Rapidan rivers and on Lee's flank. All that was left to do was crush Lee's smaller army of Northern Virginia and march on down to Richmond. If only it were that easy. Hooker's plan for the spring and summer campaign was both grand and encouraging. First, he would send Stoneman's cavalry deep behind Lee's army to cut railroads and burn bridges in order to cut off his lines of supply and retreat. He hoped, too, that this would distract Lee from the main thrust of his attack, which was to hit him from behind as he focused on Sedgwick's Sixth Corps on the other side of the river. Once the outnumbered Lee was crushed, Hooker would march his army to Richmond. If Hooker's plan had such elegance, its execution did not. Stoneman's cavalry raid only met one of its objectives. The flanking march achieved the element of surprise. However, Lee, seemingly undaunted by this envelopment, split his army in two, sending the bulk under Stonewall Jackson to meet the threat to his rear. Hooker lost his nerve and decided he would await an attack from Lee. Fighting Joe Hooker had given up the initiative. On the night of May 1st, Lee and Jackson held a council of war to decide on what to do next. Something needed to be done. They were badly outnumbered. Jackson told Lee that Hooker's right flank was in the air, a term meaning that it wasn't anchored by a topographical feature like a hill or a river, and that he knew of a road that could help conceal his troops as he moved them on a flanking march of the Army of the Potomac. When Lee asked which of his troops Jackson would require for the operation, Jackson's reply was simply, "All of them." And so, the next day, Jackson led his men, some 30,000 strong, on a dozen-mile march around the Union right. Holding the Union right, for now, was the pious Major General Oliver Otis Howard's 11th Corps, made up mostly of German immigrants. By afternoon, reports filtered into Howard's headquarters, and to Hooker's, about Confederate troops being spotted to the west of Howard's position, which was facing south. Three colonels in Howard's corps reported personally to headquarters. All three reported being laughed at and sent away. Hooker, too, was receiving word that a large Confederate force was moving south, away from the battlefield. He took this to mean that Lee was in retreat, yet he chose not to attack the minuscule force still remaining in his front. Still, to err on the side of caution, he passed word along to Howard, too, with advice to protect his right from attack. "We have good reason to suppose the enemy is moving to our right," the order read. "Please advance your pickets for purposes of observation as far as may be safe in order to obtain timely information of their approach." Even Division Commander Carl Schurz reported to Howard his own observation of Jackson's troops, urging him to reorient the line and face west instead of its current facing of south. He was ignored. The attitude at the 11th Corps headquarters was that intelligence should come from the top down and not the bottom up. From the bottom, especially the bottom of the 11th Corps, it was nothing more than the frightened overreaction of those damn Dutch. Rather than take heed of the warnings he had received, Howard sent his only reserve, the brigade of General Francis Barlow, south to assist the 3rd Corps at Catherine Furnace, and went along with them to see what he thought was the main show. On his own initiative, General Schurz ordered three regiments to face west and sent patrols in that direction down the Plank Road. Even these resulting reports of Confederates on the right were scoffed at headquarters. Late in the afternoon, as Howard's men were preparing coffee and food, a massive wave of deer, turkeys, rabbits, and the like came charging out of the woods. At first, the Union troops laughed and jeered. Some probably thought of what a nice meal some of the animals might provide. But their amusement wouldn't last long, for hot on the heels of the wildlife came the wild-eyed troops of Robert Rhodes's Confederate division. Howard's 11th Corps was caught totally off guard. Rhodes's rebels swept through the Yankee camps as 11th Corps soldiers fled for safety. Just five Union regiments offered resistance until they too caved to the massive gray wave. At Wilderness Church, Carl Schurz was able to wheel his division to face the approaching Confederate tide. One Union soldier observed, "Not more than 2 minutes before, Schurz's men were facing south. Now their front was to the west, in unbroken line, shoulder to shoulder, to stem the torrent of men." 20 minutes of firing and being outflanked on both ends of the line compelled Schurz to call retreat. Other officers in the 11th Corps were able to rally together pockets of resistance, which were easily overcome. One 11th Corps soldier remembered, "It was a perfect whirlwind of men. The enemy seemed to come from every direction." Captain Hubert Dilger's battery held its ground until it too was overwhelmed. This action would later earn him the Medal of Honor. Returning against the steady stream of retreating men, General Howard, mounted on his horse, tucked an American flag under the stump of his arm which he lost in the Peninsula campaign, waved his pistol, and tried to get his men to stop, rally, and stand with him. "Halt! Halt!" he shouted. "I'm ruined! I'm ruined! I'll shoot if you don't stop! I'm ruined! I'm ruined!" One observer determined that Howard was completely confused and bewildered, later adding, "None of us knew or cared where he went." Jackson's men pushed Howard's 11th Corps back nearly 2 miles. A phenomenon known as acoustic shadows kept Joseph Hooker and his headquarters in the dark until the 11th Corps men were upon them. The commanding general and his staff tried to beat their frightened comrades into submission with the flat edge of their swords. It didn't help. And some 11th Corps men were so frightened that they ran clear into the Confederate lines on the other side of the battlefield.
You've just heard a portion of an episode from the podcast Addressing Gettysburg. Be sure to search for and follow Addressing Gettysburg for more.